Welcome to the Wampa's Lair Podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl Eclair and Jason Hunt, discuss all things Star Wars. So join the conversation and hang out here in the Wampa's Lair. Hey everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair Podcast. This is episode number 220, Planet Telling, Part 1. I am, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt. Yes, I am back. And with me, the Han Solo to my Luke Skywalker, we have Carl Eclair.
Well, I'm dead, but that's okay.
Oh, well, I'm not thinking that far out.
Han Red Cup.
Because we're buddies, and I missed you, because I was gone last week.
Yeah, I did not like having to record by myself, Jason. As I said before we hit the record button, I blame you. So,
well, blame my friend Kyle for getting married.
All right. Well, yay. Weddings are fun.
Yes. It was a blast. I had a blast back in Texas seeing old friends and old places. It was weird driving near my old house. It was bizarre. Anyway.
Yeah. That's always like an odd nostalgic feeling.
Because it doesn't feel like home anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that every time I'm back in my hometown, because my dad sold our childhood home, but he lives 2 miles up the road, so I literally drive past it every time I'm in town, and I'm always so like sad at like how it looks and that it's not our house anymore. So, but anyway, enough reminiscing about us. Glad you're back, because I'm really excited about these next two episodes we're going to be doing.
Yes.
In case you're curious, what we're going to be up to, I thought it'd be really fun because obviously one of the hallmarks of Star Wars is all these incredible planets we get to visit. And really what's so great about the Star Wars stories is the fact that these stories, the planets themselves are part of the story. So what we're going to be doing, obviously today in part one, is we're going to be looking at the planets in the prequels, kind of looking at the planets sequentially in each of the movies and how they add to the story, how they act as part of the storytelling element of Star Wars. So I think this is going to be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to doing it.
I think so, too. When you told me that this is your idea for the next podcast or two, I was really excited about this. And what made you think about doing this? What brought this about?
Or
was it just a random idea that floated into your head?
Yeah, it's to be honest, a lot of when I come up with a show idea, I'm just like sitting around and I'm like, you know what, this would be fun, and then I immediately write it down. Or well, now that we have a Google Drive, I throw it in there, so
right.
So like I can share it immediately with you. But yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to remember where exactly it came from. Oh, I was watching Phantom Menace the other week, and really. I'll get into this more particularly today, as well as when we wrap up next week. But there was something about I really felt a connection between Naboo and Endor, and I'm going to talk more about that specifically in our next episode. But and I just started thinking, I'm like, wow, these planets really enhance the storytelling. Like where we end up tells us kind of where the story is too. So again, and part of the genius of George Lucas's storytelling,
right.
So that's kind of what we're going to be focusing on in this episode and next episode. So hopefully you guys enjoy it as much as we're going to enjoy talking about it.
Yes. And real quick, before we get into the topic, since I was gone last week, we did not get our matchup up. So we'll be reintroducing that at the end of this episode. So stick around for our matchup at the end of this episode.
Yes. And before we hop into the episode as well, we want to give another shout out to one of our Patreon supporters, Clark Wilson, who is the unofficial official sponsor of this episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. So, Clark, thank you so much for saving a Wampa and for sponsoring this episode of the Lair.
Woohoo! Yay, Clark! Is he really Superman in disguise?
Yeah, I know. He just changed his last name. He's clearly Superman.
Right. He's changed the last name from Kent to Wilson, and I suspect there is a red cape in his future.
So thank you, Clark, for your support on Patreon, and to everyone again who has continued to support us on Patreon. As I said in the last mini episode, if you caught that, Jason and I, our goal is for this month and the 2 months leading up to Celebration, if we can have $75 pledged each of those months – we're going to do nightly recap episodes from either the hotel room or the stage, or not the stage floor, but like the exhibiting hall, somewhere in the somewhere there, we will sit down and record some quick recap episodes each evening for your listening pleasure.
Yes. So, for our Patreons.
For our Patreon supporters, yes. So if you're interested in that, please feel free to head over to patreon.com/wampuslayerpodcast and drop some credits our way. Hey!
Woohoo! Republic credits are good out here. Yeah. And so are Whoopi Whoopi. So,
Whoopi Whoopi!
Whoop Whoopi! Chuba! Sorry, anyway. Wow! Anyway, let's stop making sound effects and get on with the show.
Yes. And so let's...
There we go.
Yeah, we haven't done that in a little while. I miss them. Yeah, I miss Foden Bead. You know, this episode of The Wampas, we're going to be talking all about planets. Oh, man.
I think the dog next door is not liking Foden Bead right now.
Oh, too bad.
I'll close the window.
So anyway, like I said, we're gonna kind of chart the Star Wars story just by looking at the planets and how this. Obviously, we know the story so well; it's so ingrained into us that it's going to, you know, kind of bleed into how we see the planets. But the planets themselves, the settings, the colors of each planet, kind of furthers the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with Phantom Menace. Which, by the way, I love that movie. Love that movie. I watched that twice in a row. When I watched it last week, I watched it at night, and then I watched it again the next morning because it was like another, it was like another snow day. I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch that again while I do work today. And I loved it just as much. So I'm currently listening through the Ultimate Edition soundtrack. I never listen to CDs in my car because I just use like Spotify on my phone. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to bring in that the Ultimate Edition CD in my car, and I'm just like slowly listening through it. And I've been quoting it all along, too, because you know how it goes in sequence with the movie. I've been so proud of myself. So,
oh, man. I miss this type of conversation.
We dare not go against the Jedi. Viceroy.
Viceroy, I don't want this stunted slime in my sight again. This telepathy is unfortunate. We must accelerate our plans. Begin landing your troops.
My lord, is that legal?
I will make it legal.
And the Jedi?
The Chancellor should never have brought them into this. Kill them immediately.
Yes, yes, of course. As you wish.
Boom, we got a scene.
And we're good. Now let's get into the topic.
Okay, yeah. Let's do it.
So Naboo.
So Naboo is
the first planet we see in the Phantom Menace.
Yes. And what
do you want to bring up about this?
So to me, Naboo is, it's so perfect that it's the first planet we see in this story. Again, if you watch episodes 1-6 as a whole story, our story begins on Eden in a sense. You know, Naboo is, it's this beautiful, green, lush planet. You know, it's full of vibrant life, natural life. And it kind of mirrors the state of the galaxy. When episode one begins, the galaxy is at peace. It's from the sounds of things, it's been at peace for 1,000 years. You know, yes, there's conflict throughout these planets for sure, but there hasn't been a full scale war since the formation of the Republic.
Exactly.
And Naboo is kind of the image of that, right? It's this beautiful, peaceful, life giving planet. And it's a reflection of where the galaxy is at the time.
Right. It's one of those things that's funny you mentioned Eden because, you know, that's in my notes too. It's sort of it's like a troubled Garden of Eden because while it is this on the surface, it's totally this picture of peace and tranquility and all this stuff. But of course, you know, it's got this very Renaissance feel to the Naboo and Thebes city and the picture that they present to the rest of the galaxy. But under the surface, there's this very tribal warrior type class with the Gungans, and there's tension between the two races, and so there's that underlying tension underneath this sheen of peace and tranquility, And that's definitely a perfect image of the galaxy as a whole at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, our Star Wars saga begins on a vibrant, lush, flourishing planet with its secrets, with its secret tension beneath the surface. So, yeah, like, that's really where our story begins. So, even in Eden, there's trouble a-brewing.
Exactly. So, exactly.
But our story then, is there anything else you wanted to say about Naboo?
Well, I just want to point out that, remember, keep this in mind as we go through the rest of the story, that Naboo is both the homeworld of Padme, who is, you know, a fighter for the light and the good, and Palpatine.
Right.
So we know where he ends up, cackling maniacally with lightning coming out of his fingers.
Yes. Sorry. I'm trying to pull up. I want to see if I can find this piece of music that when we first see Theed and we see Naboo, you get this beautiful piece of music. It's off the Ultimate Edition. It's called Queen Amidala Warns the Federation. So excuse me one second while I try to find this. I think this is them talking.
Yep.
Here we go.
Do you think she suspects an attack?
I don't know, but we must move quickly to disrupt all communications down there.
And here it is. The negotiations haven't started because the ambassador isn't there.
Well, how can that be true? I have assurances from the Chancellor the ambassador did arrive.
Chancellor Palpatine. Senator Palpatine. Check the transmission, General. Panaka! Sorry.
Well, also communication can mean only one thing. Invasion.
Or it could mean the internet's down.
Right. Which we have no idea what that's about.
I just wanted to grab that little piece because it's very short, but again, it's played kind of on flutes. It's this really beautiful, like, looking place. And, I love that. This is why I love Phantom Menace, because it shows us the state of things as they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously things are going to be undone.
And deteriorate rather quickly.
Yes. So from Naboo, we travel then to Tatooine, which is a very common planet in the Star Wars story. And it's going to come up a lot in both this episode as well as next episode. And I feel like each time we go to Tatooine, it does do something a little bit differently. It's used as a story element a little differently in each of the films. And essentially in Phantom Menace, it's this remote, desolate planet that's kind of in the backcountry. It's in the backwoods.
Right.
And it's a safety. It's a safe haven in the midst of trouble, right? Like, it's where they can go to hopefully make some repairs and hide out from the threat of the Trade Federation until they can continue on to Coruscant. So Tatooine and Phantom Menace, it's this very warm and isolated place, but in that isolation is safety.
Right. And as a whole, you know, Tatooine's isolation from the galaxy and the desolate landscape, you know, really kind of inspires in characters like Anakin a need to escape, a need to leave, a need to get off the planet. It's the homestead that everyone wants to get off.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the notes I have here is that Tatooine is pretty much, you know, a backwater world where the most interesting thing about the planet is its people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and Tatooine, the thing that I kept thinking about as I was, like, making notes, though, is Tatooine, though, is a planet of light. You know?
Yes.
It's the twin sun planet. Now, I'm sure in Star Wars there are other twin sun planets, but we don't see any. No, and that's not to say that they don't exist. You know, we get planets with multiple moons. We see those. Right. But it's the only planet that visually shows us twin suns. And I think what Tatooine also represents, even in Phantom Menace, is, again, the fact that it's like it's the backcountry. Nothing good could possibly come out of it. But that's part of the story, right? Like, it just makes me think in the gospel stories when Jesus tells people he's from Nazareth. They're like, what good can come from Nazareth, right? It's kind of like a podunk town and off the beaten track. Tatooine is this podunk planet off the beaten course.
Right.
And out of it, though, is there's all this light there, though, and something wonderful is going to come from this desolate, what seems to be barren planet.
One specific location on Tatooine I want to mention is going to be the pod race arena, because this is definitely taken right out of ancient Rome. It's the chariot arena.
Mm-hmm.
It literally is the Roman chariot arena set in space. So, and the pod racers, two engines in front of a little chariot, you know, yeah. and that pull the chariot along. It's a chariot race.
Yeah.
Ben-Hur.
I was just going to say Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur in space.
Yeah. yes.
So I just want to bring that up because it's literally – George Lucas takes a lot of things from ancient Rome here in the prequels. And we'll get to some more of that later, probably in our next planet, actually. But but yeah, there's a lot of ancient and Rome that takes place in the prequels. So
yeah.
Be prepared for it to get mentioned again.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it going off that's such a great thing to point out is the pod racing arena. Also, though, the most common setting that we are on this time at Tatooine, and again, this is a place we'd never been in the originals, is slave quarters. You know, we're inside we're specifically Shmi's and Anakin's home, though. You know, mm-hmm. it's Tatooine is also kind of a homely planet. It's mm-hmm. it's a place where you can rest and relax, even in the midst of the harsh suns or these chaotic windstorms. There is a safety there. Again, like I kind of said, when that's the reason we're going there in the story is we're looking for safety. And we even right. get that visually in where the primary place we spend a lot of time, especially where the character development happens, is in this house, you know, this little right. slave house. So Tatooine in Phantom Menace is its home in a way.
It is.
Which makes sense because to fans, again, when you saw that movie the first time, Tatooine is the most common planet in the originals. So mm-hmm. the fact that it's being presented as like kind of this home front is it that jives very well with how it's been used in the past.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. Did you want to move on or?
Yeah, let's go to the center of the galaxy.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And that's so from Tatooine, we go to Coruscant and Coruscant
from isolation to complete immersion in people, in politics, in society, everything. This is like Washington, D.C., London, Paris, New York City, and Beijing all rolled into one.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget Boston.
Well,
it's big, okay? It's not that big for a big city, but I love it. Yes, Coruscant is – it really is, though. It's the center of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. Everything kind of – it's the spoke in the wheel in a sense. And when we go to Coruscant, what we see is this massive city with a tremendous amount of organized life. Everything on Coruscant, though, is man-made. I mean, Rick Ollie tells Anakin as they're pulling in, you know, the entire planet is one massive city. You know
– yeah.
To me, in Phantom Menace, Coruscant somewhat represents the Tower of Babel. You know, you have these massive buildings that reach to the heavens, and they're mm-hmm. all created by human beings. Well, obviously aliens too, but you know, it's humanity's attempt to reach the heavens on their own volition.
Right.
And that's what Coruscant represents. It's the center. It's the apex of all organized life. That centers around a Senate and a Chancellor and a Jedi Order, right? Like those are the settings that we go to on Coruscant is the center of politics and governance and the center of religious life in a way.
Yeah. And that is one of the things I had on here is that, you know, it's definitely got direct ties to ancient Rome with the Senate there. And then Middle Ages Rome as the seat of religious power in a sense, and except we've got them kind of blended together here, in a way where the Jedi sort of serve the will of the Senate, but they are definitely their own entity, and they've definitely been set up in a place of power, in a seat of prominence, because the Jedi Temple can be seen for miles and miles and miles, no matter what side of it you're on. So it's a little hyperbolic there, but that's and some of the things that happen here on Coruscant, especially as Palpatine, you know, calls for a vote of no confidence in Valorum, and you know, ends up rising to power, is rather very directly tied to the rise of Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. So after World War One, it's a lot of history happening.
Right.
A lot of historical connections happening on Coruscant, and I'll bring up some more of them as we go. Yep. So
that's kind of, you know, where our story takes us next. It's they use Coruscant to show us why life is so good. Right. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the reason we have the Eden on Naboo is because of the tremendous hard work of these people on Coruscant who are making sure that, you know, things are well governed and people are treated well and equally and this, that, and the other thing. So Coruscant is, we go there to see how everything is structured and why everything's structured. But again, like you kind of insinuated with Naboo, when we get there, and again, this isn't specifically the planet, but we learn there that there's trouble brewing there as well.
Right. Right. There's definitely unrest. It's a very corrupt place too. And Padme realizes that. And it's one reason why she just sort of throws up her hands and returns to Naboo, because nobody's going to deal with her situation until it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad you said that, because let's go back to Naboo one last time. And I think the reason we go back to Naboo in the Phantom Menace, well, there's lots of reasons why, but even just visually, when we left Naboo, we left it in a bad situation. We left it in the state of being overrun by this mechanical army. Naboo is a place where natural life exists, but it's being overrun by these battle droids and these machines. So when we go back to Naboo, the story takes us back there to restore life, to restore things to how they were supposed to be. And that's why, like, Phantom Menace, even just like A New Hope, and even in a way even more so than A New Hope, is a very well complete story, right? We start on Eden, it gets corrupted, so when we come back to that corruption to restore it to its natural state of goodness.
Yeah, and George Lucas, especially in the prequels, likes to play with the idea of man versus machine, and this is our first real look at that, and how the Jedi and the Naboo and the Gungans were able to stand up and, despite their differences, you know, form an alliance and unify in order to overcome the machine.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yes.
And literally and figuratively, because the Trade Federation is kind of a machine in the cog of galactic corruption. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Do you want to move on to Attack of the Clones?
Let's do that.
So
we've got a lot to talk about on Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, what's interesting is, you know, in the OT we essentially get three planets in each movie. Same with Phantom Menace, but Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith really have us hopping around.
Yes.
There's a reason for that, you know, there's things are mounting in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But Attack of the Clones, as well as Revenge of the Sith, which we'll get to a little later, but opens on Coruscant.
Yes.
But what's different about Coruscant in Attack of the Clones than Phantom Menace is the parts of Coruscant we're essentially going to see. We see essentially in Attack of the Clones that Coruscant is a planet of kind of leisure, and there's a vibrant nightlife. And there are so many beings crammed together that they are basically oblivious to actually what's going on in the galaxy. You know, they're so caught up, you know, the specific, you know, when Obi-Wan is, or Anakin are flying, chasing Zam Wessel, you know, what we're seeing in Coruscant there is all these people just going about their lives, just trying to enjoy their lives, you know, Jedi poodoo, you know, like the Jedi are just getting in the way. Everything is an annoyance because there are all these, you know, vibrant, fluorescent, like, advertisement billboard signs all over Coruscant, at least this part of Coruscant. And it's obviously selling them on a leisurely life of fun. And so on Coruscant, I think that's so important that the story starts there because we know things, again, are like very from the opening crawl. We know things are really getting, you know, splintered here in the galaxy. But the people on Coruscant, they don't really seem to care. They're kind of
it's not affecting them directly at this point.
Exactly.
So they're going to go about their lives of leisure. They're going to wrap themselves in this, you know, false sense of security because it's Coruscant. Nothing's going to happen here, you know.
Yeah.
And one thing I want to note is that we only see inside the Jedi Temple twice in this entire movie. We get it when Obi-Wan and Anakin are given the assignments, their assignments. And then we get it at the very end when Yoda talks about, you know, the hell wasn't a victory and begun the Clone War has. So most of what we see on Coruscant is political or it's in Padme's apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the story starts with... yes, like her apartment, you know, there's an intimacy.
I take that back. I'm sorry. There's other stuff in the Jedi Temple.
Right.
I'm thinking the Jedi Council chamber for sure.
But yes, he's obviously in the library.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, what we're seeing on Coruscant here, so this story starts with, again, a galaxy that's oblivious to the bigger picture, but also for even our individual characters. You know, Anakin is spending a lot of time initially in Padme's private apartment. You know, so it's creating tension.
Yes, it is. Awkward tension, but tension definitely. So yeah. Do you want to move on to...
Yeah, that's really all I had to say for Coruscant here.
You know, we'll return to Coruscant shortly.
Yes. I'm going to look at Naboo first. Anakin and Padme go back to Naboo. And what's, again, we see the same old Naboo when we first show up. You know, it's that beautiful, green, lush planet. Mm-hmm. But we see a very, an even more beautiful side of, even more intimate side of Naboo. You know, by the waterfalls, you know, the beautiful grass prairies.
The villa.
Yeah. I mean, this beautiful house she stays in, you know, Naboo is very much a romantic setting in Attack of the Clones. It's meant to, you know, mirror those romantic feelings between these two characters. And also at this part of the story too, I think it kind of reminds us how good it can be in Eden, right? Like Anakin and Padme are in Eden now, and that's having an effect on them. Like, he feels comfortable enough to open up about his feelings, even though she doesn't want to admit it. She does admit that she has feelings as well.
Yeah.
This particular setting of Naboo for Attack of the Clones is very much about showing us it's this beautiful place where love can happen.
Right. Right. But at the same time, as with Eden, they're still dealing with the temptation of the knowledge of good and evil, so to speak. You know, the temptation of the romance outside of the purview of their jobs. You know, that Anakin is not supposed to form attachments, but he definitely wants to. She's a senator. She can't really be seen having a scandal with a Jedi, although I think that becomes less of an issue for her after they get married. But he's not supposed to have these sort of attachments. But they're definitely towing that line. They're discussing it. They're, you know, it's one of those things where the temptation is there and they're fighting that temptation. And they haven't quite eaten that apple yet, that fruit yet, but they're definitely toying with it at this point.
Oh, Padme takes a bite right out of it. The woman's first, even in Star Wars. that's so obvious that's kind of what's going on here is they are in Eden and they're being tempted. But yeah, I mean, I really like that we go back to Naboo here, and it's, you know, Naboo is beautiful in Phantom Menace, but here it's like a romantic beauty, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very intimate encounter with Naboo, you know, talking about, yes, we don't see them lying in the sand. I wish we did, because, you know, it gets everywhere. but, you know, we see them having, like, we see them in these very intimate locations, you know, and those locations, you know, that we go to, it's like, these are places you go on a honeymoon. Like, Naboo is, mm-hmm. it's a great honeymoon site in everything we're seeing in Attack of the Clones. It's not just like, oh, let's go here for a family vacation. No, let's go here with my significant other because this is a beautiful place.
Exactly. This is, they're in sort of the honeymoon phase of their the reunition of their relationship. They've reunited, they're kind of in this honeymoon phase, and it's very tempting to take that to the next level, which they shouldn't.
Right.
So,
right.
But at the same time that we are seeing Naboo, Obi-Wan's on a very different planet.
Yes.
Kamino.
Yes. And Kamino,
one of the things I just wanted to note that I thought was weird about Kamino is that the design of the Kaminoans and the design of the cities is very reminiscent of you know, flying saucers, the whole idea of being abducted by aliens, you know, that sort of thing that kind of permeates our culture. It's like, it's this sort of like someone has taken you out of the rest of the story, and is sort of dissecting what's below the surface. It's really weird, but I kind of like it. So,
yeah, that's such a cool observation, Jason. I mean, I'm sure lots of other people know it, and it's there in my subconscious. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the Kaminoans look exactly like our understanding of what a UFO looks like, and everything is saucer shaped. And a lot of, I mean, UFO abduction stories are oftentimes about, like, them making hybrid, you know, like, hybrid species with aliens and human beings, right? Like, there's always, like, this kind of invasive, procreative, like, testing going on in UFO abduction. So how interesting that Kamino very much mirrors what our cultural thinks about aliens.
Right. And it's, you know, instead of the invasive, you know, procreational testing that's going on, they're genetically reproducing clones at an alarming rate, you know, in a way that's, you know, not human. They look human, but are they really?
Right.
So,
yeah. Right. But I love Kamino. It's one of my favorite visual planets. Again, it's got some Dagobah to it with the rain. But no, it's Kamino is, and again, this is going to be very interesting with the poetry of the PT and the OT. You know, these middle act movies take us to a very dark, mysterious planet. Uh-huh. For the prequels, that's Kamino, and it's rainy, it's dark, and it's shrouded in mystery, you know, and that's what's essentially going on in our story here is we're trying to uncover some sort of mystery. He's Inspector and Obi-Wan right now. He's Detective Kenobi.
Exactly. It's a mystery shrouded in an enigma.
Yes.
Yes. It's
or as Jerry Seinfeld says about Newman, he's a mystery. He's a mystery wrapped in a Twinkie. Sorry for Seinfeld fans. I love Seinfeld. Sorry. Anyway, side note. And I totally butchered that. But Kamino is, I love it. It's rainy. It's dark. And again, we don't know. We don't know what's going on there. And again, at the top of the show, like we played that. I love this piece of music for Kamino. And I'm just going to throw this again real quick for us. Here we go. How good are those cymbals too, right? Like mirroring that, the sound of like, you know, the ocean surf. So cool. John Williams is incredible. Kamino is great. And when we're inside Kamino, when we're in Topoka City, whenever we're in, you know, in the interiors, it's this sterile hospital-like environment, which makes sense because they're making clones, but it's very unnatural, really. You know, I mean, they're walking by these vials of full of little babies that are being created. You know, I mean, Kamino is a place, right? Like it's a water planet. All life stems from water, right? Like that's NASA's always looking for a planet that has actual water. We can suspect that there might be life there. It's the building block of life. But on Kamino, life is being manipulated. It's not natural.
No. The dark side is not the only thing that leads to some things being unnatural. So, anyway, I just had to throw that in there.
Anything else to say about Kamino?
I don't think so. Other than the fact that obviously, you know, that's where we're getting the clone army and, you know, even the reasoning why it was built in the first place and how it was built in the first place is a mystery. Everything about this place is a mystery. It wasn't on any charts. It, you know, the army there is a complete mystery as to who did it, why they did it, and how it was brought about. So it just happens to be there for such an occasion as the circumstances the galaxy is being thrown into right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting.
But we've returned to another planet.
Yes, as our favorite planet to return to is Tatooine.
Yes.
But we're going to see a different side of Tatooine in Attack of the Clones. What Tatooine kind of represents here in our story is danger. It's a dangerous place. And it's a hostile environment. You know, that's what we kind of get into here. I mean, yes, we start by going back to Mos Espa, where things somewhat feel normal. But then when we're actually taken out in, we're on a backcountry planet and we're about to go into the backcountry of a backcountry, you know?
Right.
So
right.
It can't get any more on the fringe than that. And when Anakin goes out there, when our story takes us out to that part of Tatooine, it's a wild place and it's dangerous. And the Tuskens, these indigenous people, embody that. They are what endangers our story. And more than that, what Tatooine kind of comes to represent here in Attack of the Clones, in my opinion, is it represents the inability to kind of control nature.
Right.
So Kamino, we go from a place where everything is under control. Everything is being manipulated and controlled. On Tatooine, though, you have a very wild natural environment that can be dangerous.
Yeah.
And as so far as that's important to our story is, because that's kind of real life to a certain degree, right? Like there are a lot of things outside of our control.
Yeah.
And that becomes a stumbling block for Anakin.
Right. You know, and obviously the biggest thing that's out of control is the whole issue with the Tusken Raiders taking Shmi and what Anakin has to do to try and get her back. And even when he gets there to rescue her, she's at the point of, you know, of death. And even though he's there to rescue her and he does take her body back, she dies, which is completely out of his control, and he can't stop it. But even small little things like the fact that Watto is now a struggling junk dealer rather than a, you know, relatively successful one in Phantom Menace shows that even the little guys don't have any control. Everything on Tatooine in Attack of the Clones is just out of control, out of people's control. They don't have any control over what's going on with their own lives. And while, yes, the primary focus is this tragic, you know, story of Anakin and his mother, even Watto's falling on hard times.
Yeah. Yeah. And how interesting, too, because think of how much that contrasts with the Tatooine of Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a home. It's a safe place. It's a home front. But here we come to Tatooine and it's a dangerous place and where anybody can be down on their luck, you know?
Right.
So, and that's, again, this is so good that like, so Kamino and Tatooine, you know, playing off of each other here, and we're about to hop into Geonosis as well. All three of these planets take us to mysterious, dangerous, threatening places, which is so perfect because that's where our story's going. We are about to get to the Clone War. And
right.
Each of these planets kind of start taking us on that journey. Kamino, you know, what's going on here? There's something going on beneath the surface, and whatever it is, it's not good. And then
right.
we go to Tatooine, where just the forces of nature are even out of whack and are violent and aggressive. And holy crap, you can't control this. And now, if you don't mind, let's hop to Geonosis.
Okay.
And Geonosis is, it's a very barren planet. Geonosis is somewhat similar to Tatooine. The mm-hmm. difference is, though, is to me, the color palette is a little bit different. Now, granted, I'm no artist, so I can't speak to this with any sort of expertise, but Tatooine has like soft, warm colors. Geonosis mm-hmm. is much harsher, like orangish, hard yellows that are, to me, at least more aggressive, hot mm-hmm. colors as opposed to warm. Tatooine, I would almost yeah. define as warm, Geonosis as hot. Right. I don't mind being warm. Yeah. I don't like being hot.
right.
And Geonosis is a hotbed of very, very much conflict.
Oh, yes.
So did you like that? I wrote in my notes, it's a heated place. Dink, dink.
yes. There you go.
thank you.
it is one of those things where it really is kind of just a backdrop for the events that are going to take place. It's stark. It's barren, it's, you know, not appealing in any sense, and it is a bit aggressive looking, because yes, the colors are slightly aggressive, but it's also got these random rocks and spires that stab into the sky. It's an aggressive looking location, even in its barrenness, and it serves as a backdrop for the coming war and the beginning of the tragedy of the fall of the Jedi and the galaxy at large. So, and of course, you know, the Geonosis Arena is the Roman Colosseum. Mm. It's plucked right out of ancient Rome, and it's a gladiatorial arena where the Christians or the Jedi are thrown against the lions or the Reek and the Nexu and the Acklet. You know, it really is just completely plucked out of ancient Rome and dropped into the Star Wars galaxy in a very literal sense. So,
yeah, that's so true. And you know, and even the, you know, the droid factory, it's a war machine, you know, it's war production. And, you know, what's interesting and even this specifically the arena where most of the conflict begins and kind of carries itself out is look at all the onlookers, right? Like we're celebrating this, right? The Geonosians are there to celebrate violence. And
right.
that is kind of, you know, it's tipping the scales towards a galaxy-wide conflict. Think of things even, you know, like the ancient, you know, Colosseum in Rome. You know, that was a sport. It was a way to outlet your aggressiveness. You know, we have, you know, the NFL. It's an aggressive sport. We like to be aggressive, but we want it to be under a certain level of control. Geonosis, there's no rules, though. And that's the scary thing. You know, this is a planet where, and by the way, that there, while Tatooine is also barren, there's a lot of life. Like we see a lot of life. We see a lot of like settlers and villagers, and we see indigenous life. Geonosis just seems to be overrun by this, you know, these bugs in a sense.
Right. It's infested.
Right. Exactly. And like bugs to us, you know, or they're exactly that. They're a nuisance. So mm-hmm. even the life there is annoying in a way.
Right.
So Geonosis, I like the way you put it. It becomes a backdrop to the conflict that's about to break out.
Before we wrap up Attack of the Clones, though, I do want to real quick return to Coruscant, because what we see in Coruscant with the the vote to grant the emergency powers to Palpatine. In Attack of the Clones, Palpatine is Julius Caesar.
Mm.
He's Julius Caesar. He's convincing the Senate to give him the powers of the Emperor, basically. You know, he's charmed them into giving their own power to him, which is straight out of Roman history. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the historical parallels aren't just, you know, it's not just parallel, it's direct. It's, you know, almost point for point. Mm-hmm. It's really remarkable that, you know, so Palpatine is Julius Caesar in Attack of the Clones. He's convinced the Senate and the people at large that he is the one to be trusted. And so they voluntarily give over their own power and their own control to this man who they believe is going to do it, you know, use it for good. And then he just kind of keeps it for himself.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I mean, very interesting that we go back to Coruscant, because I didn't even think to mention this. I'm glad you brought it up, Jason. Yeah. 1000% right with the Julius Caesar. But even before we get to the Julius Caesar moment, we also have a secretive meeting, right? We go to essentially what kind of looks like the sewery section of Coruscant, right? Like, we have all these steam pipes and what almost looks like a garbage dump, like an industrial garbage dump nonetheless. But, and that's where, you know, these steaming piles of evil are meeting to plot this martial event that we're about to see. So
right.
The very, you know, when Coruscant at the beginning of the movie is about something different than it is at the end here. At the end, it's about secrets and plotting and evil and now ultimate power.
Yes.
I have good news for you, my lord. The war has begun.
Excellent.
Everything is going as planned.
Love that moment. So let's go to the last movie in this trilogy, which is Revenge of the Sith, and which we get a lot of planets in this movie for sure. But we're just going to kind of concentrate on the ones that are part of really the main story. You know, there's obviously we get like 3 or 4 planets alone just for Order 66. But we don't go there to stay. We go there just for that's there for montage effect. It's not there for storytelling effect in a sense.
Right.
The planets themselves aren't part of the story. We only go there to make it real that their galaxy is, you know, the Jedi are spread very thin throughout the galaxy. So they're very vulnerable.
Right. Exactly. But where do we start? We're starting Coruscant, don't we?
Start on Coruscant again.
Again. Jeez, Coruscant.
Yeah. And
go away. No, I'm
kidding. You know, I'm kidding. One of the things I love about Coruscant visually, and we see it a lot specifically in Revenge of the Sith. Now, granted, it's there in Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones as well. But, you know, I made the point earlier that Coruscant kind of is the spoke in the wheel of the Star Wars galaxy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of visual shots from space of Coruscant where you see this huge ring, like these particular cities that are kind of set up in rings, like the, and then there's a spoke in the middle. Like, there's a lot of, if you look at the planet, it actually looks like there's a lot of wheels involved, which I just think is really cool visually.
It is. It's very, very neat. Very, it definitely lends to the idea that this is the center of the known galaxy, you know, almost literally, but definitely figuratively and politically as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and the story begins here with, in a sense, again, that Coruscant represents the center of the galaxy, and the center of the galaxy is in chaos. You know, the story begins with a huge battle over the center of the galaxy. You know, and again, it's a very clear reminder of what the Clone Wars have done to the galaxy. It's totally knocked things out of whack.
Yeah, it really has. And those people from, you know, Attack of the Clones, who went about their daily leisurely lives thinking that the war and the trouble of the galaxy would never come home, well, not so much anymore. They've got pieces of ship raining down on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's one thing that still stands out to me in Revenge of the Sith, though, is even after all that, once the battle's over and things have settled down again, Coruscant becomes a city of night. It becomes, you know, it seems to be most vibrant at night. Mm-hmm. As if people are most comfortable living in the dark, right? Like, mm-hmm. they're comfortable living at night. Which,
again, In the shadows.
And then that's such a great visual storytelling. You know, all the big things that happen essentially on Coruscant in Revenge of the Sith happen at night. You know?
Yeah.
You know, there's not much going on during the day. And even when there is, you know, like, there's the great scene when Anakin's being appointed reluctantly to the council, the clouds outside of the temple, right? Like, that are so thick and, like, really preventing the sun from shining, you know,
obscuring the light.
Exactly. And all the big things happen at night. And I just think that's so great, because that's exactly where our story's gone. The story is, you know, we are falling into the nighttime, you know, the good times, the light is coming to an end. And to me, this the one of my favorite scenes in Revenge of the Sith that kind of encapsulates that is when Anakin is swearing allegiance to Palpatine after they've killed Mace Windu, and he's becoming Darth Vader. Just I remember just a few months ago when I watched it, just watching that scene and just watching the, you know, the busy traffic outside the window there. Nobody has a care in the world, right? Like, what we have going on in this room is essentially the corruption of the Chosen One, the corruption of the hope and promise of the galaxy,
right?
Being, you know, manipulated by the devil himself. But out just outside that window is people, you know, going to the clubs, you know, worrying about like just the most base things about life, just
coming
totally
home from work,
yeah,
you know.
Just oblivious to what's going on again. And it's I'm not indicting the citizens of Coruscant, but again, right. It's just to show that, you know, these monumental things that are happening, though, it's important that they're happening in the shadow, just beyond the view of everybody else, right? Like, and we're really learning this a lot, by the way, side note, but in the new canon that we're getting a lot of, that a lot of what, you know, the old canon seemed to, the stories all presuppose that all the characters knew the stories like we did. The new canon is much more, I mean, we get this a lot in Bloodline, you know, the redemption of Anakin Skywalker, that's all very private moments. And they were private moments in the film, and they are kept and cherished as private moments. So the galaxy at large doesn't still really necessarily know that Vader's Anakin, and, you know, which is why there's so much tension like there is. And obviously that's probably part of why Kylo falls. We learn in Bloodline, by the way, spoilers ahead, sorry about everybody, but, you know, Ben Skywalker, or Solo. For that matter, Ben Solo does not know the full truth where we're at in Bloodline, right? So I obviously that's going to be cataclysmic for him. So I say all that for, I don't know why, but just again to point out the difference
to bring back the fact that a lot of these major events are happening in the shadows.
Yes.
And that, you know, the whole idea that the people of the galaxy at large, the citizens at large in the galaxy, don't know the story like we do.
Right.
And that's set up really, you know, firmly with the prequels.
Yeah.
So it's, and one other thing I think we're just sort of addressing Coruscant as a whole at this point, because we bounce back and forth between Coruscant throughout the entire movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I was going to, yeah.
But one of the things that, one other historical perspective that I, you know, character that I want to bring into this with Palpatine and Coruscant is in Revenge of the Sith, he's a lot of things, but one of the big things he is Caesar Nero. We get the Great Fire of Rome, and he, you know, fiddles as Rome burns, as they say. And one of the interesting things is that it's not officially confirmed, but it is suspected that he may have had the Great Fire set to begin with, in order to clear space for his palatial expansions.
And then scapegoat it onto a particular group.
Right, exactly. The Christians, the Jedi.
Right.
You know, it's we're getting ancient Rome again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's and Palpatine is another one of these horrible historical figures. And yet he's winning. Yep. You know, he's winning at this point. He's doing it the right way, according to, you know, without getting caught, essentially.
Right. And he's being applauded for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So he's still got a bit of that Julius Caesar stuff when he, you know, takes, you know, forms the first galactic empire for a safe and secure society. But then as Coruscant burns and the Jedi Temple burns, and as Coruscant is forcibly pulled into this galactic empire with violence, he's Nero fiddling as Rome burns, you know, and blaming it all on the Jedi. So he's a dastardly human being.
Good word. Yeah, that's great. I don't have anything else to add there. That's
so what are some of the other planets we want to catch here?
Like I said, there's a lot of planets in Revenge of the Sith, but I think the next big planet insofar as our story goes is Utapau.
Mm-hmm.
And Utapau is a planet I've never liked. So just personally, like I don't like the story that happens there either. I don't know. Whenever I watch Revenge of the Sith, I fast forward most of the Utapau stuff. I don't know why. I just don't care. Maybe it's because I don't really care about Grievous. So the conflict with him and Obi-Wan just doesn't matter to me. I wish the prequels never had Grievous. I think it would have been great if we just had Darth Maul and Count Dooku. But that's a side note. Doesn't matter. But what Utapau, insofar as the story goes, is, again, it appears to be, at least on the surface, somewhat of a barren planet. But life exists beneath the surface.
Yeah.
It's this sunken planet, and life, you know, thrives beneath the surface. But what we don't know right away is, well, actually we do, because we see Grievous go there before Obi-Wan. But what's going on is life is, again, somewhat similar to Phantom Menace. It's being corrupted by this mechanical army. And, you know, when you know, Obi-Wan looks up shortly after he arrives and he sees one of the space station, you know, circular ships embedded into the side of one of the, you know, the city walls. Like, it's very clear that they're like the Borg. They're just, you know, inserting themselves.
Infestation.
Yeah, exactly. And basically what this planet represents, again, is Utapau just becomes kind of a symbol of all the planets that have been affected by the Clone Wars. Now, granted, yes, we have this great TV series that really fleshed out the Clone Wars for us. But in the films, yes, we don't really get much of the Clone Wars. But Utapau represents all that we need to see. You know, when the Clone Wars affects a planet, it corrupts that planet. It takes away what's natural to it. And I think what's really cool on Utapau is you have, you know, creatures like Boga. That's the alien's name, right? Or the thing that Obi-Wan...
The creature's name, the species is a Vractal, but her name in particular is Boga.
And what I like about Boga is, you know, as an indigenous species to Utapau, you know, again, it's probably not like a sentient being. It's somewhat analogous to a Tauntaun.
Right.
But you're so good at that. What's so cool about Boga, though, is she represents kind of this wildness, you know, and how nature itself is trying to rebel against these monstrosities and these infestations, and how it's trying to restore itself. So that's kind of, to me, what Utapau represents as far as the story goes.
One last key aspect is we really see the initial spark of Order 66 here on Utapau. And the truth of it all kind of, you know, the truth of Order 66 falls into the sinkholes of Utapau, is the note I wrote. You know, the fact that this is basically Palpatine wiping out the Jedi. You know, this is his plan. He put this in place, and this is, you know, what he designed all along. And the truth of that all falls into these sinkholes, and it doesn't get out, you know, in a very metaphorical sense, obviously. And it's shrouded in the dark and the mystery of the Coruscant nightlife as well. But we really initially see that truth and how that's going down against the Jedi there on Utapau, and it just falls. You know, we see Obi-Wan and Boga fall down to the bottom of the sinkhole, and the truth of what's going on literally sinks with them. I just found that interesting.
I like that point you just made, and this doesn't obviously have specifically to do with planets, but that is a great shot, though, when Obi-Wan and Boga fall down and they end up in the water. How much that scene is kind of like a baptism. And what I mean by that is when Obi-Wan rises up out of those waters, nothing's the same.
No. You know?
So it's a transformative scene where his old, like he drowns in his old life, right? In a sense, like that was the point. He was shot down to drown as a Jedi, to die as a Jedi. And he rises up and he has to be something different. He can't be the same old Jedi. No, he's still a Jedi, but I don't know. I'm just, again, this is a side tangent. This has nothing to do specifically with the planet itself. But I like that you keyed on that scene, because I'm just thinking how actually visually stunning that scene is for being a transformative moment, not only for Obi-Wan, but for the Jedi Order. And
right.
Obi-Wan, as we've talked about before, is he is kind of the personification of the perfect Jedi. So it's right. great to interpret the Jedi Order through his character. And when he rises out of those waters after the backlash of Order 66, it becomes very clear very quickly that the Jedi have to change.
Yes.
So that's kind of the baptism by fire moment, in a sense, for the Jedi in the galaxy.
Right. And one final thing that I want to address, you know, kind of in that similar vein, happens to do with Kashyyyk. And I don't think you had any plans to talk about Kashyyyk. So I just want to bring this up before we move on to our other final really big planet that we're going to talk about. Kashyyyk is kind of, you know, Yoda went there because he has good relations with the Wookiees and all this stuff. And so it's supposed to be the place where friendship keeps you safe and all this stuff. But then he suffers this huge betrayal. And he and his friends can't stand against it. You know, I don't know if it has anything really to do with the planet itself, but I thought it was a good point and I wanted to bring it up. So,
yeah, no, that's really cool. Yeah, I didn't have Kashyyyk on there because to me it was just more just another.
Let's get the Wookiees in.
Yeah.
Let's get the Wookiees.
Right. The well, and also just like let's show more of the Clone Wars, right? Let's just show how it's right. how it's affecting the galaxy at large. But no, that's a great point. So might as well go to the last big planet of the prequels, which is Mustafar. And
Mustafar equals hell.
Yep. That's as simple as it goes. I mean, you could wrap it up just by saying that. Mustafar is the personification of hell in the Star Wars galaxy. And it is the most hostile, dangerous planet in all of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. One wrong step, you're dead, you know?
Yeah.
And something that I think is visually wonderful about Mustafar is the amount of ash that's flying around, right?
Yeah.
We see ash constantly flying around when we're outside on Mustafar. Mm-hmm. And to me, it kind of represents, Mustafar represents how everything in the galaxy has been burned up and is now like ash, right? That's where our story takes us to. It's everything's gone to hell, like literally. Everything's gone to Mustafar. So our story in the prequels ends on hell with all this ash in the sky of what used to be. The Eden we started with on Phantom Menace, that's gone now. Everything's been consumed by the fires of anger and hatred and power.
Right, right. And in a very literal sense, Darth Vader, at the end of this, is quote-unquote, think, purified in fire.
Mm.
You know, the goodness of Anakin is almost completely burned out and purified out of Vader. Obviously, there's a little bit left because we'll see that, you know, in the subsequent trilogy. But, you know, he's purified in this fire. Not only is this hell, but it's also the purification for all that is evil. You know, it hardens that evil that has now taken hold in the galaxy. And one other kind of interesting thing I wanted to bring up is that by the end of, you know, Revenge of the Sith, and by the end of what we see on Mustafar, Anakin has pretty much gone through each of the nine circles of Dante's hell from Dante's Inferno. And the circles from the outside to the inside, outside being the least, you know, severe circle of hell, and to the middle being the most severe, are in this order: limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, anger, heresy, violence, fraud, and treachery. So he kind of, you know, in a very almost literal sense, travels through each of those circles on his way and ends up at the very center of hell in the galaxy. I just found that interesting. So
yeah,
very George cool. Lucas is smarter than anybody gives him credit for.
Well, luckily lots of people are giving him credit now because it's well deserved.
So,
I'm just going to quickly throw in, just because the last place we do see in Revenge of the Sith is Alderaan and Tatooine. Only time we ever see Alderaan on a Star Wars film is this brief scene in Revenge of the Sith. And I think, again, and this is what I love about Star Wars in general, and I also love about George Lucas's storytelling, is we knew how Revenge of the Sith had to end. We knew it had to end in tragedy, and Mustafar perfectly personifies the tragedy that the movie ends with.
Yes.
But in perfect Star Wars fashion, we end on a note of hope.
Right.
And we go to Alderaan first, which is somewhat, again, we don't see much of it, but the very brief glimpses we get, it's somewhat indicative of Naboo, right? It's kind of this blue-green lush planet where you can assume life is. And the only scene we really get is on this balcony scene. I love balconies. And it's safe, right? Like, it's a safe place when they cradle little Leia, you know? And then we end on Tatooine with a sunset, or is it a sunrise? I'm not exactly sure. I think it's a sunset, but...
I think it's a sunset.
Yeah. And
because they're looking out at the same place that Luke was looking out in the sunset in that same place. There you go.
There we go. But we end on Tatooine, I think, which is important. You know, in Attack of the Clones, when we were on Tatooine, it was a scary, dangerous place. But when we come back here, it's more similar to what it was in Phantom Menace. It's a place...
We're returning home.
We're returning home. And it's a place where light prevails and saviors come from. Anakin was supposed to be a savior figure. He screws up. Well,
right.
We've got a backup plan.
Right.
But, you know, so I love that Tatooine is the last visual planet we see in this trilogy, because it starts in Eden, ultimately ends in hell, but, you know, kind of like the epilogue, if you will, is Tatooine, which is a reminder of good things come from here. This is a light-bearing planet, so...
Right.
Don't give up hope, you know.
Yes,
because rebellions are built on them.
Yeah, exactly. So. And we're gonna have a new one very shortly.
Yes.
Oh,
well,
that was fun.
Yeah, and when I started doing the notes yesterday, I was like, "There's no way we can do all these movies in one sitting.
No.
There's too much to say."
It really is.
And that's the great thing about, you know, Star Wars planets. They're all cool in their own unique way, but they're also so unique because of what they add to our story.
Right.
You know, I mean, if we go to Kamino and Kamino is like this bright, fun, happy place, that doesn't fit the story.
No. You know,
it has to be kind of rainy and cloudy and gloomy. You know,
mysterious.
Yeah, we can't end Revenge of the Sith, you know, on like a planet similar to even like Geonosis. Like, it needs to be hell itself.
Right.
You know, so these planets themselves, these settings in Star Wars are so important to what happens in the story.
Right. They really are. They're key to reinforce the story that's going on. And the setting itself mirrors, in many cases, the emotion or the plot of the story that's happening there. And it really is a genius in storytelling that really plays on that to as good an effect that George Lucas does. Yeah. So many people do it. Not many people do it as well. Right. as George Lucas does. And I think that's one of the really high points of the prequels, is that we're able to use each of these planets in this fashion.
Yeah.
In this way. So.
Yeah. Completely agree. So you guys know what's coming up next. You know, next week we're going to finish this off by looking at the planets of the original trilogy. Although I did realize we should probably throw in at some point Rogue One and Force Awakens.
We'll figure that out.
Yeah, we can always throw those two at the end of a shorter episode in the near future. Because there's some great planets in Rogue One and in Force Awakens, but we figured for right now we would just do the six saga story planets.
Yes. Because the sequel trilogy isn't done yet, and that helps inform the full story. You know, we only have part of the story so far with the sequel trilogy.
Right.
But right. Anyways.
Well, Tatooine played a huge part in both trilogies because it's the home place of the heroes. Jakku is the home planet of our hero in Force Awakens. I wonder if we'll end up on Jakku again in episode 8 or 9. Time will, I mean, obviously time will tell. Time. So we'll see if they're faithful to that tradition of planet visiting. I wonder if we'll go to Tatooine in the sequel trilogy. I kind of doubt it, but I'd like to see it if again it makes sense to the story.
Right. We could return to Jakku because, you know, she wanted to so much,
right,
in The Force Awakens to try and find her family. We could go back.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Again,
we'll see.
Time will tell.
Or maybe she'll move on like Maz Kanata told her to.
Yes. And Luke will probably encourage her to as well.
Yes.
So,
anyway. All right. Anyway, that was great.
Yeah, that was a good time. That was a good time.
I like talking about this stuff.
Yeah, me too. I appreciate the historical insight you could bring.
Oh, I love history. So, you know, that's my expertise with this sort of episode. It's not quite as much in the original trilogy that's, you know, directly historically related. But with the tragedy side that the prequel brings, there's plenty of opportunity to slip historical and literary Absolutely. References and figures in there. So
right. Yeah. The OT is more of a hero's journey. The prequels is more of the story of it's a tragedy as well as the fall of a republic.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway. Yeah,
exactly.
So
well,
yeah, before we go, again, just a reminder to participate in our matchup for next week, which we will get up in between now and then, which yes. was basically just a gunfight between Padme and Director Krennic. So, you know, just think of Padme at the height yes. of her combative career and Krennic.
Whether you want that to be The Phantom Menace or Attack of the Clones or The Clone Wars or whatever, but... I don't know which one I'm going to pick yet, but yeah, Krennic too. This is going to be an interesting one. I think we mentioned this last time we brought up the matchup. I think this is our first male versus female matchup that we've done.
Yes, it is. It definitely is.
So,
unless we put Ahsoka against somebody, but I feel like we put. I don't remember. I know she's been involved in some, so she might have been in one. I don't remember.
She might have been.
It's been true. It's been 5 years, so it's tough.
right. It's tough to tell for sure. But I'm really curious about this one. I think this could be a fun matchup, so I'm really curious to see what people think.
Yes, so definitely let us know.
And my opinion is open to being swayed, so if you make good arguments, it might sway my opinion. No, I'm kidding. Sort of. Anyway. And Carl, if people want to weigh in on that matchup, weigh in our discussion here. Where can they do that?
They can do it on Facebook, facebook.com/wampaslairpodcast. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/wampaslair. You can shoot us an email at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. And like I said, if you want to help support us on Patreon, head on over to patreon.com/wampaslairpodcast.
Anything else before we wrap up this episode?
No, this was as fun as I was hoping.
Good. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. This has been episode number 220, Planet Telling, Part 1. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we will see you next time here in the Wampa's Lair.